Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
COVID-19 increasing in America. Meanwhile, meat processing plants and farmers getting very concerned. And today on the show, tell the bosses we're coming, and a top immigration attorney in America. Good afternoon and welcome to the Tuesday, June 30th edition of America's Workforce, recorded in Cleveland, Ohio, for workers all across America. You can still find us online, awfradio.com. And you can listen to this show, any show we do, Monday through Friday, wherever you stream podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio, just some of the platforms that we're on. We have two guests on the show today. Sean Richmond will be joining us. He was one of our regulars some years back when we did the segment with In These Times magazine. Sean is a great guy. Spent a decade and a half as a union organizer and representative. He is currently the program director of the Harry Van Arsdale Jr. School of Labor Studies out of Empire State College in New York. And he's been writing in the American Prospect, as I mentioned, In These Times, the New York Daily News, as well as the New York Times. And he's out with a book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. Now, we've been talking on this show ever since COVID-19, how you are seeing more and more workers saying, you know what, the working conditions at our place of employment are not very good. Take a look at the Amazon workers, grocery workers. I mean, I could go down an entire list of industries where workers are speaking out primarily because their pay is very low. Their benefits stink, and they're not getting the personal protective equipment that they need to do their jobs in the middle of a pandemic. Long hours, low pay, parental leave, sick leave, job security. I could go on and on and on. Well, Sean says it's time to bring unions back from the edge of what he calls institutional annihilation. But it's not going to be easy. This pretty much an action plan for U.S. workers in the 21st century by which we can internalize the concept that workers are equal human beings entitled to health care, entitled to dignity, job security, and the right to strike. Tell the bosses we're coming. He says, describes what it would take, some changes that are within activist power and some that are going to require legal reform to put unions in workplaces all across America. It's not going to be easy. We all know that. He even talks about union density because right now, and we've said this on the show many, many times, the polling indicates there's a lot of support for unions today, 60%. That's 3 out of 5. Okay, then why do we have only like 11% union density in America? And we're lucky to have that because of the public sector. Public sector density is over 30%. Private sector, around 7. In some areas, like in the Carolinas, it's 2%. We got a long way to go. And we're going to have some fun with Sean as our first guest right here on America's Workforce. Joining us a little bit later is David Leopold. He's been on several times. David Leopold is one of the top immigration attorneys in America. And he is past president, past general counsel of the Washington, D.C.-based American Immigration Lawyers Association, the premier Bar Association of Immigration Lawyers and Professors in the United States. He's been on TV. He's testified in Congress. He frequently writes for MSNBC, CNN, USA Today, The Hill, and the Huffington Post. Great credentials. And we're going to take a look at DACA with the Supreme Court ruling of, what was it, maybe a week or two ago, and what the future is for immigration in America. What's next? Apparently, Donald Trump is about to restart family separation. He won't give up on this issue. I mean, his base absolutely loves it. And David has been very vocal on this issue. If you check our website and past shows, you'll understand where he's coming from. And we'll be joining with him today to take a look at what's going on in America and what may change if Donald Trump doesn't win re-election. So this is going to be a fun show today. Well, activists in Northwest Arkansas are protesting Tyson's failure to protect workers from COVID-19. Protesters marched in April and May at Tyson's Berry Street Poultry Processing Plant in Springdale and the nearby Chicken Quick Plant in Rogers, Arkansas, demanding that the plant shut down for cleaning and then implement measures to better protect workers. Makes sense, right? Well, Tyson's testing across its 7 plants in Northwest Arkansas has revealed that about 13% of its workforce contracted the virus. Family members of Tyson employees who contracted the virus say the company pressured them to return to work quickly, even threatening to deny them hazard pay if they stayed home sick. Great company, huh? Meanwhile, poultry processing is an important part of the economy of Northwest Arkansas, and workers in the industry are disproportionately immigrants. In one area, apparently, which is comprised of essential workers, about half the COVID-19 deaths in the region were Hispanics. Hispanics workers are disproportionately represented among both poultry processing workers and COVID-19 cases. Like other meat and poultry processing companies, Tyson benefits from the Trump administration, which in April issued an executive order declaring the industry essential. Said they couldn't shut down. Meanwhile, in another corner of the food production sector, COVID-19 outbreaks among migrant farm workers in Michigan now account for much of the spread of the virus there. Farm workers are at high risk of infection because of their crowded, employer-provided housing and transportation, dependence on their essential work, as well as language and immigration barriers to health care. Boy, I tell you, in response to these outbreaks, about 50 workers at Primex Farms, this is a pistachio farm in Wasco, California, they went on strike, according to the LA Times. The workers' demands include face masks, gloves, and transparency about the extent of a recently reported outbreak among dozens of their co-workers, according to the United Farm Workers, which is supporting the striking workers but does not officially represent them. The company did not share information about the outbreak, which the workers instead learned about on the news. Watching TV. Oh, there's something going on? That's my place. I work there. Primex operates thousands of areas of pistachio and other nut orchards all across California. And the strike already may have won some improvements. Primex closed its farm over the weekend to clean it up, and they hired a mobile testing facility to offer free testing to all of its workers. That happened yesterday. All right, there's a drug that got some accolades. I think I'm pronouncing it correctly, remdesivir. And apparently what it does, if you contract COVID-19 and you take this drug, your recovery time is shorter. Good news. Good news. Well, guess what? The people that make the drug, Gilead, they just decided to jack up the price. Not by 5 or 10 or 20%, how about 30%? So it will now cost more than $3,000 for a 5-day treatment in the United States. This has prompted the Alliance for Retired Americans to issue a press release. Rich Fiesta sent this out yesterday. He said Americans already pay the highest prescription drug prices in the world, yet this is another example of a drug corporation taking advantage of a worldwide pandemic and putting profits over people. Our Alliance retiree members, the most vulnerable COVID-19 population, are left paying for this greed. And he points out the American people invested at least $70 million in taxpayer dollars to develop the drug. But we have no say in how much Gilead can charge for it because our government put no strings on our investment. So, Congress needs to take strong action to finally end the drug industry's monopoly power to set prices for life-saving drugs as high as they want to. Rich goes on to say, Gilead has shown that we cannot trust drug corporations to do the right thing and make critical drugs affordable rather than more expensive for all who need them. Seniors face the greatest risk during this pandemic, and they are likely to be harmed by most of Gilead's action. This is the part so many people don't understand. The drug companies say, oh, we have to raise the prices for the drugs because of all the research that we do. That is the biggest lie going on. You and me and every taxpayer in this country are pretty much laying the groundwork for research when it comes to these drugs. In this case, $70 million. And then they gouge people that take the drug. Unbelievable. And they got the biggest lobby in Congress. All right, we have to take a break. You're listening to America's Workforce. Our segment about telling the bosses we're coming with Sean Richmond coming up next. Don't go away.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output. A half million strong, we're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
Nurses, doctors, and caregivers at the VA are under attack. They face hostile management, callous agency heads, and an administration that's stomping all over their ability to speak up for our veterans. Unions are even being kicked out of their offices, a direct attempt to silence the voice of VA employees. When VA workers are under attack, veterans pay the price. Costly privatization and outsourcing will run rampant, meaning fewer services and worse quality of care for our nation's heroes. It's time to stand up for the workers who care for our veterans. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferentz with America's Workforce.
Once again, welcome back to America's Workforce, recorded in Cleveland, Ohio, for workers all across America. You can listen to the show, any show we do, wherever you stream podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio, just some examples. And once you get hooked on the show, we ask you to please subscribe to our podcast and give us a rating. We appreciate a good rating. 5 stars would be nice. We try to bring good guests to the show, and one of them is on line number one right now. Enjoyed talking to him when we did the segment with In These Times magazine. He's still writing for In These Times, writes for American Prospect, New York Daily News, New York Times. His name is Sean Richmond. Sean spent quite a amount of time as a union organizer and representative. You were with the, weren't you an organizer with the teachers at one time, Sean? Welcome to the show, by the way.
Thanks for having me back. Yeah, for about 10 years I was with the AFT. For about half that time I was running the union's charter school organizing division, where we were spending $4 million a year to organize 1,000 workers.
That's a lot of jack.
Which got me thinking that the system is maybe broken.
Yeah, a little bit, right. This is your first book, though, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, it's a book that I couldn't have written if I was still on active duty. And, you know, it's my writing it in these times in a lot of ways was the first draft of this. You know, I left the union in the fall of 2015 to start a family, and I just started writing, you know, playing with some ideas of, you know, what's wrong and what we could fix about it. And so the result is this book, which, you know, we wanted to get out during the election year. We were hoping to get it out. We were hoping it would get it out when the primaries would still be hot and heavy. It's sort of a funny book because it's got, you know, it's like a Frankenstein's monster of a book in terms of the audience that we're aiming at. Because, you know, I really want to get into, you know, shoot my way into some conversations on Capitol Hill. But it's also a really useful book for activists because it's got some ideas here and like strategic items that are actually within our control that don't require any sort of legislative reform, that are just things that we just haven't chosen to do for whatever reason.
And the legislative reform, we've tried. We had the, what was it called, EFCA, the Employee Free Choice Act, under the Obama administration. Yeah, that was effed up, right?
And right now the current sort of standard bearer legislation is this thing called the PRO Act, which would, amazingly, it would essentially repeal Taft-Hartley. Get rid of right to work laws. It would allow unions to engage in more solidarity activism by taking the dispute to not your direct employer, but a company that does substantial business with them, which is actually the bigger damage that Taft-Hartley did, I think, is it outlawed solidarity. But it's not enough. It would not bring unions back in any substantial way. That the real problem here is we have a labor representation system that is based upon an individual workplace by individual workplace model that the employers have largely seceded from. They spent 50 years offshoring, subcontracting, and gigifying employees so that they don't have to have responsibility for their company and their workers. And that's really the bigger problem with labor law. And the PRO Act won't fix that. I've been saying this, you know, saying it throughout the primaries, you know, for in these times, every time one of the candidates would come up with their labor platform, I'd review it. And, you know, it's in some ways it's kind of amazing to think that we're in a position that, you know, repealing Taft-Hartley was the gold standard of what the AFL-CIO, you know, of its legislative agenda for decades and decades and decades. And now we're in a position where that is the official Democratic position, that they're going to repeal Taft-Hartley. And it ain't good enough. You got to do better than that.
Mm-hmm. And right to work grew out of Taft-Hartley, did it not?
Yes. Taft-Hartley created a carve-out under federal law that said, well, states can pass a law of that. And actually, it's actually sort of debatable what Congress meant when it passed that and what right to work actually meant. And if we had a decent judiciary in this country, we could have a really interesting debate about whether it was meant to ban fees for labor representation or whether it was meant to ban simply forced union membership. And there's some scholarship that says that actually probably in 1947 Congress just meant to say you can't be forced to join a union, you know, to have your job. But it didn't. Mm-hmm. But it was silent on, you know, whether you have to pay fees because there's still a union doing all this work for you.
So you're talking about legislation here. Now, legislation, obviously, it would be good to have pro-worker legislation. And it's just been so difficult, as you pointed out. You are of the opinion that workers need to kind of do this on their own. And I think we're starting to see that, especially with the pandemic. You're seeing the strikes at Amazon. Well, they're not actually union strikes, but they're workers that are being very vocal. The food and commercial workers. I was just talking about the farm workers and poultry and the meat processing plants, where it's just ridiculous the conditions that are in those plants right now. Do you feel that, I guess for lack of a better term, the times are a-changing right now? And we're seeing polling indicating that unions are a good thing in America. What's your thoughts on that, Sean?
Yeah, we got to bring the strike back. And, you know, I've got a very long chapter in the book about strikes, you know, that strikes are contagious. But it's very hard to get workers to strike on the levels that we need to. If most workers have never participated in a strike, they've never seen a coworker go on strike, or a friend or a neighbor, and win. That's the crucial thing, and win. And So, you know, when I was writing this book, you know, 2019 was a pretty incredible year for strike activity in the 21st century in America. It was a very notable uptick in strike activity. But also, I was trying to splash some cold water on that to say, like, well, you know, all we did is we got to 1986 levels of strikes. And 1986 was a really lousy year for strikes. Because the contagion runs the opposite direction, too. We tend to talk about Reagan and the air traffic controllers. That was symbolic. What really happened is a copper mining company in Arizona called Phelps Dodge hard bargained their employees to impasse over draconian cuts in benefits and hours and wages, forced them out on strike, bust in thousands of scabs, and kept the mine open for a 12-month period so that at the end of that, the scabs could decertify the union. And that became the blueprint for how you bust a union in Reagan and Bush's and Clinton's America. And so in that sort of circumstance, workers saw strikes as something you lose. And bosses worked that into their captive audience meetings when workers were trying to organize unions. You know, you're not going to get anything unless you go on strike. And if you go on strike, we could permanently replace you. And it was devastating. So you get to the year 2019, the year 2020 in particular, if you're in an Amazon fulfillment center, your back is really against the wall. If you're at a McDonald's, your back is against the wall. You know, your life is literally at stake. So what do you have to lose? You have your life to lose. You go on strike. And I do think that we are potentially in a historic strike wave at the moment. It's hard to tell because all the journalists are getting laid off, and there's no government agency that's gonna, you know, that's capturing the numbers. But workers are learning something from this experience. But in my book, you know, I mean, for labor activists, you know, for that audience, you know, I'm saying that there are things that are within our control. But it's complicated, you know. I mean, it's amazing that we have a left for the first time in forever. You know, there's tens of thousands of people who consider themselves socialists who are working on plans and developing a labor activism model. I contend with that a little bit too, because the so-called rank and file strategy, there's a lot within it, and it's very flexible. My understanding of it is that really it's an admonition of, if you are, you know, if you're a footloose 25-year-old kid and you want to get involved in labor, don't just get a career as a union staffer. Now, that's good advice. But what it seems to be in practice is, you know, there's sort of this knee-jerk impulse to sort of oppositionalism. You know, well, let's go get a job at a unionized workplace and do a caucus and, you know, run an opposition slate. As if our problem is, you know, that we don't have the right leaders. It's not that we don't have the right leaders, it's that the system is a trap. And that if you became president of your union, you'd be stuck with the same lousy rules and lousy laws as everybody else. And what's more interesting is whether we intentionally don't form unions, right? Like, the power of what the Amazon workers are doing right now is they're organizing, they're striking, but they are very consciously not forming a union, because a legal union in this country is a pair of handcuffs, particularly when it comes to engaging in solidarity activism. An example of the stakes here. I'm certainly recall when Nabisco shut down their Oreo factory in the city of Chicago and shipped those jobs overseas.
Right.
Two, 3 years ago. Now, the appropriate response, right, would be that every grocery store worker, certainly every union member grocery store worker in this country would, you know, when a truck of Nabisco shows up to the supermarket, say, well, we're not gonna put that on the shelves. I'm not gonna ring that up. We're not touching that product. That would be the power of solidarity. It's completely illegal. And by illegal, I mean, it's not just like a slap on the wrist illegal, like when the boss breaks the law. The boss would be able to go directly to court, get an injunction, and slap triple financial damages on the union for whatever they claim, and they can make up a number for what they're losing. And of course, they'd make up something around the $1 billion mark, and no union has $3 billion in the bank. The unions would be put out of business the officers would be held personally liable. You know, you'd lose your home. It's not just like a law that we're too, you know, chicken to break. It's that it's a law with real teeth that would destroy lives.
Yeah.
And so don't be a union in that case. You know, the workers who are organizing at Google also are very consciously not forming a legal union. They're organizing. They're engaging in walkouts. They're doing some incredible stuff. I mean, if you think about Google, you got workers across the world. So they've got a patchwork of laws, and they're talking online. They've got all kinds of systems for keeping in touch with each other, and they're figuring out, you know, they're getting back to the basics. What can we do today to get our point across to the boss? Mm-hmm. And so those are some of the changes that we have the power to make and that we need to consider more as a labor movement.
Sean, I got to take a quick break. Can you stay with us for another segment here on America's Workforce?
Sure.
Okay, real good. Sean Richmond is his name. SeanRichmond.com is his website, and he's out with a book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, a new action plan for workers in the 21st century. Perfect guest for this show. Dave Leopold will be joining us. He is a top-notch, nationally known immigration attorney. He's going to talk about DACA and what's ahead for immigration in the United States. All part of America's Workforce. Back in a few.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
For over 20 years, organized labor has turned to the BMA Media Group for communications and events needs. Because BMA knows how to positively impact labor's issues and spread the union message. The BMA Media Group is a union marketing, public relations, production, and events firm. So BMA Media knows what it takes to help unions capture market share, conduct marketing campaigns, partake in political education, promote labor management, organize membership development, and support issues such as prevailing wage, project labor agreements, responsible contracting, and workforce training. They also plan and produce special events such as conventions, conferences, and anniversary celebrations. The BMA Media Group, marketing union value for you. To learn how the BMA Media Group can assist your labor organization, just visit bmamedia.com. That's www.bmamedia.com for all the labor tools you need to move your union into the future.
Part union newsletter, part industry trade magazine. The Labor Citizen provides the most comprehensive coverage of the issues that matter to the hard-working members of Ohio's labor trades. Building trades unions that subscribe to the Labor Citizen guarantee their members receive a monthly report crafted by their own union leaders, along with interesting feature stories and news relevant to Ohio's union construction industry. The full-color tabloid is already being delivered to active and retired members from nearly 50 different building trade unions. You won't find more comprehensive coverage of the news and issues important to Ohio's labor trades anywhere. And the only way you can have this valuable monthly publication delivered to your mailbox is if your local union decides to join. If your building trades union is not receiving the Labor Citizen, ask why at your next regular meeting. Or send an email to info@laborcitizen.com for more information. That email address again is info@laborcitizen.com.
America's Workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
Once again, welcome back to America's Workforce, recorded in Cleveland, Ohio, for workers all across America. We're still online at awfradio.com, and you can listen to the show wherever you stream podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio, just some examples. Let's go back to our live line and rejoin Sean Richmond. SeanRichmond.com is a website, and he's out with his first book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, a new action plan for workers in the 21st century. I remember the last time I talked to you, you came out with a workers' bill of rights. I understand you have a little snippet of this in your book. And I'll tell you, that's so darn important because workers are confused today. They're angry. We're working in the middle of a pandemic. We hear of essential workers, those in the food processing plants, atrocious conditions, not getting the equipment they need to keep safe on the job. If you could run down your Bill of Rights for us real quick. Go ahead, Sean.
Well, I mean, it's really about where labor law is rooted in the Constitution. And do you know where the National Labor Relations Act draws its constitutionality? Do you know?
Where?
Where? No, I don't.
The Commerce Clause. Of course.
The Commerce Clause.
That's where human rights belong, is where your impact on interstate commerce is. And by the way, because of that, civil rights law is similarly based on the Commerce Clause, which is completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so what happens is, you know, the law was declared constitutional. I mean, it was a strategy to get it past a very conservative Supreme Court that didn't want Congress monkeying around with private business. And the law becomes constitutional largely because of the sit-down strikes that happened in the interim. And then the next day, the bosses are in the courts, you know, arguing that the law violates their First Amendment rights. And the First Amendment it will always trump the Commerce Clause. So as an example, the law was really meant to be a neutrality law. It was meant to say that workers decide they have a union, they have a union. The boss doesn't get to say anything about it. And bosses said, well, come on, we have a First Amendment right to at least express our opinion. And of course the court said, yes, that's right, you do. Now, you step back to today, and what that means is, an NLRB certification election, which determines whether extra statutory protections are going to be applied to a group of workers at a workplace to try to form a union, it's an election that's run by an arm of the federal government, and the rules of which are that one party and one party only can force all of the voters into a mandatory presentation of their position. And within that presentation, they can threaten your job. They can lie. They can hire somebody to impersonate a federal agent and lie about what your rights are. And there's no right to respond. There's no equal time provision. And crucially, not only is the party that can do this only an employer, it's only an employer that advocates a no vote. If the employer was saying, hey, a union's not a bad thing, that would also be illegal. When you step back from that, how is that not a massive violation of the First Amendment? How is that not politically coerced speech? And so what I was arguing in Labor's Bill of Rights is we should think about raising more of these kinds of arguments, because the full weight of the labor law system has become blatantly constitutional, but we don't make those arguments. And partly we don't make those arguments because there's a thing that's happening, I think, in Washington, where at the international unions, the lawyers get to have the last word on strategy. The lawyers are important. They should definitely be in the room, but I don't think they should be the default last word. Because, you know, they're pursuing a very cautious strategy, which makes sense. Look, we lose in the court all the time. The courts are not our friends. Even
right.
Democratic judges tend to be fairly patrician and don't understand unions. But, you know, that's a strategy for losing more slowly. That's not a strategy for sort of attempts to break through and really just sort of lay bare how broken this system is. So I do think that we need to do a lot more thinking along those lines. I've also got a chapter in the book the book is mostly about we have to get outside of the NLRB frame, that we need more sort of all-in systems of labor representation. We need just cause, right to your job laws. We need works councils. We need, you know, industrial labor standards that get set across an entire sector. But we also do need to amend the National Labor Relations Act, and we got to do more than just repeal Taft-Hartley. And one of the things that we have to do in the Act is, and in all of our legislative drafting, if we actually get a president and a Senate and a Congress who give a damn about workers, we gotta have instructions in there for judges to back off. And one of the things that we need to do when we amend the National Labor Relations Act is we can legislatively overturn every bad Supreme Court decision on the NLRB, because every Supreme Court decision is them trying to interpret Congress's legislative intent. Well, put your legislative intent in there that says, you're wrong, we think you tend to get it wrong, we're wiping the slate clean of the Yeshiva decision, of the McKay decision, of all these just terrible decisions. We're telling you, back off, this is not your lane, you don't understand this stuff. That's really important. The preamble to the National Labor Relations Act isn't really important. And I think we need to, we need to root this act in the parts of the Constitution that actually deal with our human rights. We need to root it in the First Amendment right to free speech and free assembly. We need to root it in the Fifth Amendment right to due process, and we need to root it in the 13th Amendment right to be free of slavery and involuntary servitude.
Definitely some food for thought, Sean. I have one more question here, and this is kind of to wrap up the interview. By the way, we're talking with Sean Richmond, author of the book Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. I wonder if you could address those in the non-union plant right now. And I know we're talking about collective action. You can't do this alone. You can't do this alone. We all know that. But I'm just wondering, how do you address that group that's listening right now that's not happy about their working conditions? They're not getting their personal protective equipment. They're not getting the pay that they deserve. How do you speak to them right now, Sean?
I think it depends on whether you work in an industry where there's a union that is seriously trying to organize you. So if you are, like if you're in a meatpacking plant that's non-union, the UFCW wants to work with you and you should call them up. If you're not, then, you know, you need to find your fellow workers that are also trying to make change. Try Googling it. I mean, they're out there. It's kind of amazing to the extent to which people are talking about their workplaces on Reddit and on other kinds of internet forums. Find each other. Make a plan. Find a left-wing organization that will give you some advice. You know, find Democratic Socialists of America. Find the Industrial Workers of the World. Find the Center for Popular Democracy. And make a plan. And, you know, I mean, I'm waiting for the reviews to roll in for this book and for people to realize that. I mean, I actually spend a little bit of time in the book, you know, talking about sabotage, which I think is a tried and true labor strategy that, you know, is totally not legal and therefore got dropped from labor's arsenal for a while there. But if you're in a non-union factory and you need to get your point across to the boss, think about sabotage.
Well, you got to have a little rebel in you. You just got to watch your limits. Watch your limits on that, you know.
Yeah, that threatens anybody's life. I mean, by sabotage,
right.
I mean, you know, in classic sabotage. You know, it's more about getting the point across that you know how this place runs better than the boss does, and how you removing your sort of active cooperation causes problems.
One more question here. What do you think of the future? How do you feel moving forward here? We're in the middle of this pandemic. You know what's going on in America. We've got an election in just a couple of months, a general election for the next president. Biden's leading in the polls right now. Things could change. What's your feeling right now, Sean?
You know, I think we on the left, we give ourselves some very disempowering narratives, you know, that we're only going to get the legislative change if we can get the general strike going. Therefore, we should only focus on getting the general strike going and we can think about legislative change later, which that just means that somebody else makes the laws. And we also, you know, here's the analogy. If this is our equivalent of 1932, in 1932, I would not have voted for Roosevelt. I would not have felt great about him at all, and I wouldn't have liked much of his first term, which was a much more pro-corporate agenda than it was pro-worker. But because there was a crisis in the country, and I think there's a crisis in the country now, there was definitely a crisis in the country then. He had to deal the unions into his framework. And his first framework was the National Recovery Administration, which was, you know, again, corporate collusion. But it would set these labor codes. And crucially, it included this thing called Section 7A, right to organize. Wasn't worth the paper it was written on, because there was no enforcement mechanism, and the bosses were still shooting workers. But it was just enough to raise workers' hopes and then dash their expectations that it actually sparked a real strike wave in the year 1934. So we're not going to get enough from President Biden, but it might be enough to get some real action going.
All right, we'll leave it on that note. Great stuff, all contained in the book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. And you can find more at SeanRichmond.com. Sean, you take care. Keep up the fight, my brother. We'll be in touch, all right?
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Dave Leopold talking immigration coming up next. Once again, you're listening to America's Workforce.
This is America's Workforce.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
The Food and Drug Administration has recently reported that the heartburn medication Zantac is linked to cancer. Zantac has been linked to a variety of cancers, which include bladder, colorectal, kidney, liver, pancreatic, and stomach. So if you or a loved one took Zantac and developed any of these types of cancer, you need to call Kelly and Ferraro. 216-575-0777. Let me repeat that number. 216-575-0777 for a free case review. You may be entitled to compensation from the drug manufacturer.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferentz with America's Workforce.
Welcome back to America's Workforce, recorded in Cleveland, Ohio, for workers all across America. You can listen to the show, any show we do, wherever you stream podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio, just some examples. Let's go to line number two right now. And joining us is David Leopold. He's been on the show a number of times. A little background here. He's got a diverse immigration, visa, and citizenship practice focusing on employment and family-based immigration. He's past president, past general counsel of the Washington, D.C.-based American Immigration Lawyers Association, the premier bar association of immigration lawyers and professors in the United States. And I remember, David, welcome back to the show. Weren't you teaching at one of the local universities as well? Is that true? Are you still doing
that's
that?
That's right. I used to run the immigration program at Case Western Reserve University Law School and actually at Cleveland State. So I did teach at both of the law schools here in town.
And David has testified as an immigration law expert before the U.S. Congress and frequently writes for MSNBC, CNN, USA Today. You see his name a lot. Talk to me about the Supreme Court decision here. This was on June 18th. The court, it was a 5-4 decision legalizing DACA. That's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which was something that happened under the Obama administration. I would imagine you were a bit surprised by this. What was your thoughts?
I think a lot of us were a bit surprised. Nobody expected the court to do what it did. And in the end, you know, Justice John Roberts, the Chief Justice, joined other four members of the court and basically said to the Trump administration, look, you can take away DACA. That's your right. But you got to do it legally. And you didn't follow the law. And you need to follow the law. You're not above the law. And that was a gratifying ruling. But now what's got to happen is we've got to codify DACA. Congress has got to pass legislation to protect these young aspiring Americans who want to contribute to the United States and do contribute to the United States.
When you say they didn't follow the law, what did they do wrong then in this case?
So this case involved the Trump administration back in 2017 under political pressure from the right, tried to pull the Obama-era program, which gave Dreamers, those are young undocumented immigrants who came here at the hands of their parents, Obama-era program had given them a chance to avoid deportation temporarily and to work and go to school. The idea there had been that, look, Congress is going to do the right thing at some point and pass immigration reform, which will protect these Dreamers, these kids who were brought here as babies. Obviously, Trump won the election in 2016, and he ran on a platform of pulling DACA, stopping it, and deporting these kids. He didn't do it in the first part of 2017, but he came under tremendous political pressure to do it. And finally, in the spring of, in the fall of 2016, he sent Jeff Sessions, then the Attorney General, out to announce that DACA was going to be withdrawn. Well, they didn't do it the right way. They didn't follow the procedure. I mean, one thing about this administration is that its ideology, you know, its extremist ideology is only eclipsed by its incompetence. And it didn't even can't even follow procedure correctly, and that's what the Supreme Court ruled. So they ruled that, look, you can, it's within your right to take DACA away, but it's not within your right to just do it any way you want. You got to follow the law. It's a basic precept. They just didn't follow the directions.
I gotcha. And they'll probably try to rework this case, but that wouldn't happen. And they would have to do the arguments all over again, and that would be in for next year? Is that how I see this?
Yeah, it isn't going to happen. The good news and the great news for Dreamers is that this isn't going to happen before the election. And I think it tells us that if we have another 4 years of this anti-immigrant extremism coming out of the White House, yeah, Dreamers are in trouble. And I think the country's in trouble. So we have a chance to fix this. We'll see what happens in November. But for now, the Dreamers do have a reprieve, courtesy of the United States Supreme Court.
Yeah. Well, so many are hailing it, including yourself and labor unions. The AFL-CIO is jumping up and down because of what happened here. Our presenting sponsor, Terry O'Sullivan of Labor's International, made a point on his website how important this decision is because they're having a very difficult time attracting workers to finish construction projects because a lot of what we're talking about here. And that's the misconception. You've talked about this on the show. As you know, David, this is a labor union show. And the way the Trump administration has framed a lot of this immigration news, the way they frame the whole subject is that they're taking away our jobs.
Yeah,
and isn't it just the opposite right now?
It is the opposite. And let's, you know, start with your point on the Dreamers in construction. Well, construction industry, because of shortages, you've got 15% undocumented. In the agricultural industry, you have 50% undocumented. In the healthcare and home healthcare industry, you've got much higher percentages of undocumented, not because you're taking jobs, but because the industry is such that they need these workers. These are what we call essential workers. Look at the meatpacking industry, another industry where not only has the administration itself said, look, these are essential workers. We can't let them stop working during this COVID-19 outbreak because obviously we need meat in the stores, the food distribution. And at the same time, the administration says, well, yeah, but then we also have to deport these people. We could let them get coronavirus. Once they get the coronavirus, we'll deport them. Clearly, they don't say it that way, but that's essentially what the policy is. And all studies show, and that's why the AFL and other unions, other leading unions in this country, the ones that understand economics, understand what's going on, understand that these immigrants create U.S. jobs for U.S. workers. They create, they're job creators, not job takers, because it isn't a zero-sum game. It isn't job for job flash. People come in, they create jobs, they create industries, they create technological opportunities also, which create jobs for American workers. And so the easy selling point is that if an immigrant gets a job, she's going to take your job. That's just not true.
Yeah.
You know, the numbers, the all the credible, and I'm not talking about people on the left, people from the American Enterprise Institute, people from Cato, people from the center left, Center for American Progress, and so on, all agree on one thing. And that said, immigrants and robust immigration program in this country will create jobs for U.S. workers and raise wages. So I wouldn't buy into what this administration says.
So what's next here for immigration, David? Because I'm hearing that Trump is going to restart family separations, which was atrocious to begin with. What's the future hold?
Yeah, I mean, there was a ruling out of a judge, the judge who oversees the detained children in California, last week, and what the Trump administration has said is fine. You know what? We'll release children, but we're not going to release their parents. So parents, you have a choice. You can either give up your kids or have your kids stay in custody. That's just a cruel Hobson's Sophie's choice that this administration has put in front of the people who are seeking asylum in this country. So what's next for immigration? That is the critical question that you asked. What's next is November election. That's what's next, because many things in this country, whether it's national security, we can see what's going on with these bounties on American soldiers paid by the Russians to the Taliban, those reports. We can see what's going on with the environment. We can see what's going on with race relations and brutal murders across the country of black men and women. There's an awakening in this country, but what really is going to happen is these issues will get decided in November. That's what's next for immigrants. I think that's what's next for the country, because this country, I think, you know, it's cliche, but this time I mean it. This election decides America. That's what it decides. It's the soul of the country that's up for election.
You know, the crazy thing about this, too, we were so close. Remember, what was it, the Gang of Eight? They were close to immigration reform in this country, and it kind of fell apart. We just can't seem, and there's a lot of polarization in Congress and a lot of polarization in America. You talk about the election in November, but you still got to deal with Congress. With that being said, David, do you think this can be done with the proper people in the administration and the proper people in Congress?
Absolutely. Of course it can be done. I mean, it's not. Look, America was built on greatness. This is the country that after World War II, the devastated Europe, we rebuilt it with the Marshall Plan. This is the country that sent somebody to the moon. I mean, we have done amazing things in this country. Hoover Dam, I mean, on and on, the great wonders of the world. Of course we can fix this problem. This is a problem that can be fixed if there's some will, political will in Washington to do it. But the only way we're going to get political will is if we all vote. We vote, we get 10 more people to vote. That's how it's going to change. You are correct. We could have a change in the White House, but if we don't have a change in the Senate, it may not make much of a difference. So we do need to be sure that we send the right people to Washington, people who care about the country first, not their political future. I mean, let's be honest, all politicians care about their political future, but some politicians are willing to put the country first as well. And that's what we need.
One more question here before you go. You hear, we are a nation of immigrants. My dad immigrated from Czechoslovakia back in 1920, and there's immigrants that did wonderful things in America. But then you hear the people on the right saying, well, yeah, we're all favor of immigration, but we want legal immigration, and we don't want those illegals in here. How do you respond to that, David?
Well, if that's the case, why have they completely defunded immigration in this country, legal immigration? Why are they closing down the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services? Check the news that place is about to furlough and close, and those are the people who grant legal immigration. Why is this president suspended legal immigration from throughout the world? Why? Why have they stopped legal immigration if there's so much for legal immigration? And when this administration talks about, and its supporters talk about following the law, they had to start, you know, it's all that old phrase, people in glass houses. They don't follow the law. The law is that we do have a robust legal immigration program. It is broken. It needs to be expanded. But this administration refuses to follow it. They've stopped visa issuance. They have stopped the entry into the United States of people who have waited in line. There's a story in the New York Times that talks about a four-year-old who cannot reunite with her mother because they won't give her a visa because Trump suspended visas. So, yeah, we can talk legal immigration all day long, but if the country, if the government does not follow the law, like the Supreme Court said last week in the DACA case, then we're stuck here with nothing going on that benefits the American economy or the American people or the fabric of our culture.
Good answer. All right, David, I knew I'd get the right things from you. You take care. You do a great job on this subject. I'm sure we'll be talking to you down the road, okay?
And you do a great job. I love the program. I'm a big fan. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. David Leopold, partner with Ulmer and Byrne in Northeastern Ohio and nationally recognized on immigration. All right. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Tomorrow, Scott Paul and the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Until then, all of you, be safe and have a wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening. And be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.